At our last session, we talked about solution-focused questions and tracking. This podcast is a continuation of solution-focused principles and their application to clinical treatment.
We hope you had an opportunity to try these techniques, and that when you did, you noticed how your clients, your friend, a child, responded to them.
For me, the essence of a solution-focused approach is captured in a story written by Walter Impeller in their book, Becoming Solution-Focused in Brief Therapy. They write about a story about a baseball player who was in a batting slump. And the story is about that player and the manager of his team and the advice he received from his manager. It turns out that he was watching tapes of himself striking out in order to figure out what he's doing wrong so that he could correct it. When the manager came in, he said, asked him what he was doing, and the baseball player told him he was watching tapes of himself striking out so he could figure out what he was doing wrong. The manager said, well, get rid of those tapes. Put those tapes away. Watch the tapes when you were hitting and see what you were doing right to hit the ball, and then do some more of that so that you'll figure it out.
We've adapted solution-focused principles from the work of family therapists. As a family therapist, I would often be asked to work with a family whose child was not doing well in school. For example, an adolescent and his parents might come in and talk about how the adolescent was getting F's and D's and was really distressing everyone in the family, including himself. And I would spend time listening respectfully to each person in the family, all of whom, of course, had a different perspective on what this meant to them. And when the time was right, I asked a solution-focused question, such as, to the child, to the adolescent, among all your classes, are there any that are going just a little bit better? And in this particular case, the child responded, well, I'm getting a C- in history, rather than a D and F, as in all his other classes. And so then I talked with him about that and said, well, what's different in that class? He said, well, the teacher's interesting, and I like what he has to say. And then I said, and so how are you different in that class? He said, well, I pay attention most of the time, and sometimes I bring my book home and so forth. So we had quite a discussion about what was different in this particular class from in his other classes. And as we did that, the adolescent began to experience himself as successful, at least in one area of his school experience. And as the parents listened to that, they begin to see him in a bit of a different light from the perspective they had when they first came to treatment. So what I found in my work with families is that when we paid attention to successes rather than failures, the families would generally leave the session with a sense of hope and feeling less discouragement.
So as our thinking changes, behavioral changes are also likely to occur.
Exactly. Not that the situation changed. This young man was still getting some D's and F's, but he began to think about himself as somebody who could be competent in one context.
And then did he become more competent?
He did. He still wasn't getting straight A's, which is what his parents would have liked, but he began to take personal responsibility for what he felt that he could do in school to be more successful.
So change did occur.
Yes, it did. Now, a word of caution. This solution-focused method is not a method for talking clients out of feeling sad, disappointed, or upset. As we demonstrated in our third podcast, strong feelings must be respectfully acknowledged. And as this is done, the art of therapy is then to know when to organically shift into a more solution-focused perspective.
For me, in order to shift to a solution-focused approach, it seems necessary to learn to work within the client's reality. For example, treatment seemed not to be based on a 16-year-old's reality when he put his head on the table and became unresponsive. As we learned, however, that he collected lizards, and these were colorful, beautiful lizards, and this was incorporated, that his interest was incorporated into treatment, he became an active participant in his own treatment.
How did you learn that that was his reality, or that the lizards were important to him?
Well, I think we listened to him. We asked him solution-focused questions. We talked about his unhappiness at being at treatment, and found out in that conversation that he liked to collect lizards, and this was his hobby.
And he'd rather be home with his lizards than there with you.
I guess so.
Okay. We know how to work with clients' reality. For example, we avoid jargon when we're talking with them about the situation. We attend to their nonverbal as well as their verbal communication in order to better understand their situation.
Yeah, two important ways we learn about their realities is by listening to them and asking them solution-focused questions.
A second principle, in addition to working with the client's reality, is identifying exceptions to the problem.
This is something that the founders of our field talked about. Van Riper talked about using key words in children who had articulation disorders. So he said, listen for words in which they can say the sound correctly. And this is an example of looking for an exception. He just didn't use that word. Robert Meliasson also took a solution-focused approach when he talked about using stimulability. That is, as we give an articulation test, he said, if the person that we're testing can't produce the sound correctly, find a situation or a phonetic context in which they can produce the sound correctly. So keep searching for that exception to the problem. If they can't say it in a word, try it in a syllable. If they can't say it in a syllable, try it in isolation. If they can't do it in isolation, do it in isolation with strong cueing and in imitation. So that was a real example of searching for a solution. Another example occurred with us when the father of a child who was pretty active already, we were working with the father and the mother and this child, and the child had a pretty high level of activity, and his father seemed to even promote that. During the sessions, he would pick up the child and turn him upside down, and he'd bounce the boy on his knee, and generally seemed to be encouraging his physical activity and seemingly making him unavailable for speech-language change. He wasn't using many words. An exception to this, however, occurred during a session when the father quietly picked up the boy and slowly walked over and looked at a picture, a painting on the wall that we had. It was a large, colorful oil painting, and the father took him over there and he talked quietly about the colors, named the colors slowly. The child got very interested in the picture, started touching the pictures gently, and the father quietly talked to him. And here was a real exception to the way this father and child interacted, and it seemed as though this had the basis of making this child more available for listening to words and for imitating him and just making him a participant in treatment.
In this case, the clinician responded to what she saw the father do by saying, look what you're doing. You're holding him up to the picture. Notice how he's pointing to it, and you're naming the colors, and look how calm he is. Now, the purpose of finding exceptions is to help the client or the client's family members feel that they are full participants in treatment. We had observed that father with his kind of wild behavior, but his reality was, I think, that he was a fun-loving guy and his kid loved to play with him, and he wanted to show us how active he was with his son, and it would have been pointless for us to critique that or tell him he shouldn't do that. Rather, we accepted that as his reality and looked for an exception that fit well into what he was already doing.
Another example occurred on a home visit that a student and I went on. When we got to this child's house, who wasn't talking as much as his parents wanted him to, the mother came to the door and she said, "He said hot dog this week. He said hot dog." And she took me off guard anyway, and I couldn't think of what's exceptional about saying hot dog. And so she repeated it. She really wanted to tell us about it. So she said, But he said hot dog. He said the whole thing this week. Remember last time we met, he only said ha, and we couldn't get him to say hot dog. And yesterday, he did it. So we had a big conversation about that.
About hot dogs. And this is an example of how a solution-focused perspective, and particularly identifying exceptions, leads to client empowerment or family empowerment. Because that mother was clearly very involved in helping her child change some of the difficulties he was having and went on to do much more than she had earlier.
So we acknowledged her competence.
That's right. And that's what solution-focused treatment does. A third principle is identifying strengths rather than weaknesses. One of our clients was the mother of a child with autism, rather low on the autism spectrum, who attended sessions with her husband and another typically developing child. She told us when we were finished with our work with her that focusing on the child's abilities and on the family's strengths and making small changes gave her hope. And later, she decided to become a speech-language therapist. And as a part of that work,
her thesis was a study of scaling, another solution-focused technique that we'll talk about next week along, or in our next session, along with amplification.
We hope now that you will continue to practice respectful listening and solution-focused questioning and tracking, and that as you do this, you will attend to opportunities to shift organically into a solution-focused way of having conversations about change.
And if you wish to contact us, our email address is jmandrewsfbt@earthlink.net.